are still there for Kali and worse to worse is to come. This tradition is about this tradition, all Indian sects agree. There is no disagreement on this. Except that some of these Brahma Kumaris, they also say that Satyug is to come. But that is not an old tradition, that is a new invention of them. How to reconcile this? Shall we say that Sri Aurobindo deviated from the tradition on this aspect? Or just it is a fresh interpretation of some tradition in a way which I am not able to understand?
First of all, I don't know if you understand this tradition of yogas, that there are cycles of time. That aspect is accepted. Sri Aurobindo speaks of the human cycle. That very title that he has given to one of his books, The Human Cycle, indicates that Sri Aurobindo admits the cyclical nature of time and time movement. Sri Aurobindo also uses the word Kali Yuga from time to time. He has also used the words Krita Yuga or Satya Yuga. But somewhere in our own ideas of yugas, there is a view that in every yuga, as in the case of astrological counting of dasha system, in every dasha there is antar dasha. In the antar dasha there is svatantra dasha. And in these cycles, all the periods repeat themselves. Under the general umbrella of one idea,
Mahadasha,
many dashas come up. And if you take up this idea of Pratyantara Dasha, why should you limit only to Pratyantara Dasha? There can be still further internal dashas. To such an extent that even every day can be analyzed. And you can say in every half an hour, there is a change in your fortune, and the whole dasha can be seen. So similarly, there is a view that in this Kali Yuga, there is a cycle, at the end of which there will be a Satya Yuga. In the overall movement of Kali Yuga, there will be a Satya Yuga. So, it is in that context that this idea, if at all you want to fit in, it can be fitted. But it is true that according to Sri Aurobindo, there is this great advent, because Sri Aurobindo speaks of the end of the age of the reason. That this age has come to an end is decisively stated by Sri Aurobindo. And the next one has got to be the advent of spiritual age. In fact, he has written 3 chapters only on the advent of the spiritual age. And has described how that age will come, what are the conditions to be fulfilled, and how, what will happen when that age is operative. But this is because we want to fit in into a traditional idea of yuga system. What is that yuga system? Personally speaking, I do not myself understand. Because if this system was correct, there was first of all a Satya Yuga sometime. And according to that calculation, it should be 2 crores 40 lakhs years. I don't know how to fit in that 2 crores 40 lakhs in the human history. Then there is Dwapara, which is double of that age. And then the Treta. So how do we fit in such a huge period of time? If you rationally think about it, I am not able to fit all these ideas into their system. So, as an idea, it is, as a cyclic idea, I accept it. But in the absence of any such perception, in which such huge time cycles can be put together, it is said, for example, that we have stories in the Puranas of the Satya Yuga. Some stories are of Dwapar Yuga, some of Treta Yuga. And now after Sri Krishna's death, Kali Yuga has started. Now, Sri Krishna's death is not so much prehistorical as some people would believe it. Because only about 5,000 years, it's not very, very ancient one. So, I do not stretch myself to labor on this point. I would have labored on this point if somebody were to show that during the Satya Yuga, so many things happened. We have one or two examples, but more than one or two examples we do not know. And I cannot say how. For example, it is said, Dashrathas Ayodhya is described in a very idealistic manner. Whether such a kingdom existed or not, historically speaking, it is very difficult for us to imagine. Sri Aurobindo says that Valmiki described an idealized age. Not an ideal age, but idealized age. He gives a vision of an age in which ideals were, as it were, realized. But whether they were really realized or not, one does not know. In fact, if Dashrath's story is correct, if that idealized kingdom existed, I cannot understand why Vishwamitra was required to take away Rama and Lakshman to protect his yajnas from the attack of the Rakshasas, because there must have been a huge number of Rakshasas to be killed only in order that yajnas could be performed. That such a man like Ravana who can abduct the wife of a king, such a man existed at that time, such Rakshasa was there. How can it be called that Satya Yuga or whatever Yuga you can say, Dwapar Yuga? What are the characteristics of Dwapar Yuga at that time, where men like Ravanas, and not one, I mean they were huge, the whole Nagari was Rakshasa Nagari. So, I am not able to reconcile myself with all that concept of Puranic idea. Maybe that Puranic idea has some symbolic meaning. I cannot fit it into our physical story. Just as Sri Aurobindo says, that the geography of Puranas is not this physical geography. Even this morning we were reading a sentence where he says that this Puranic geography is not a human geography. It is an idealized geography. It is a geography which belongs to higher planes of consciousness. So in the absence of a clarity on this subject, even to comment on it, I would hesitate. I can only say that Sri Aurobindo distinguishes between three main stages of human history. The infrarational age, the age of reason, and the suprarational age. And up to the age of Renaissance, he counts all that to be infrarational age. And he says that even in the infrarational age, some peaks like the peaks of Vedic knowledge cannot be called infrarational, it was suprarational. Such periods also can come into being. In that inferior infrarational age, great heights like those of Plato also could be. Because if rational age started only in the 16th century, and Plato was much, much earlier, and yet he had reached a very high level of rationality. And Sri Aurobindo explains it in his Human Cycle that infrarational age does not mean that everything in that age was entirely infrarational. There were also cycles in the infrarational age, and during which time heights of the spiritual attainment were also reached. Heights of rationality also were reached. But they were all on a small scale. They were not widespread. While the general humanity remained infrarational, a small group could achieve very great heights. That is his explanation. The age is to be determined by the largeness, the sweep of a given idea. So up to the Middle Ages, you might say mankind was under the sweep of physical and vital being of man. That was very widely spread. Only from the time of Renaissance, reason has spread all over the world. And today science has advanced so much, it has swept the whole humanity. So you may say, therefore, that where even a common man is supposed to be rational today, is demanded of him. And if he does not become rational, he can't survive in the modern age. Therefore, you can say that present age is the age of reason. And even in that age, when Sri Aurobindo says, now the age of spirit is going to come, he says it is not that the whole humanity en bloc will rise to supramental or suprarational age. It will be a small group first of all, and an island of beings will be supramentalized, and gradually the effect of it will be felt on larger scale on humanity. So what will be the extent of this Satya Yuga which is going to come, one does not know. And then once it comes, will humanity sink below? Or will it come to an end in that way? So that once the supermind is manifested, you don't need to come down on the lower plane of existence. It will have already achieved momentum toward higher heights and greater heights. So
here is one more philosophical deviation. As far as I can understand it, in Sankhya, for example, the process of evolution is from subtle to the gross, from avyakta to panchamabhut. Whereas in this theory of evolution of Sri Aurobindo, we find that it is an evolution from gross to the subtle. How do we reconcile these two processes of evolution which are contradictory to each other?
Sankhya philosophy is not exactly Vedic philosophy. Sankhya does not fully explicate the idea of involution and evolution. In the Veda, there is the idea of involution, which is not present in Sankhya. But if you analyze it, you will find that fundamentally, the description given there is from Mahat to matter. So you might say it is a theory of involution. It's not a theory of evolution. It's a theory of involution. So, Sankhya theory is not sufficiently explicated. We usually call it a theory of evolution. But it's a very peculiar theory. First of all, it says it's a theory of the movement of Prakriti. And Prakriti is Jada. And yet it says the first evolute is Mahat. And Mahat is called Buddhi. Now how Jada in his first manifestation produces Buddhi is a great surprise. And then out of Buddhi is a principle of egoism, ahambhava, arises. Now how does it happen? There is no explanation as to why, what is the logical connection out of buddhi, out of prakriti, which is entirely unconscious, the first evolute is buddhi. Nobody is asking the question, how buddhi arises? The explanation of Sankhya is that Purusha is reflected in prakriti, but that explanation is in the human condition. In the human consciousness, you might say, the Purusha consciousness shines out in prakriti and buddhi is manifested. But in that large evolution, where there are many Purushas, how these many Purushas reflect on prakriti in such a way that buddhi is manifested first? Why should buddhi manifest first of all at all? That also is not explained. So Sankhya theory of evolution is itself, to my mind, a kind of a reflection of the Vedic theory, but in a slightly distorted manner, in the following sense, that if Mahat is the principle of the supermind, which is the case of the Veda, Veda speaks of Mahat, and from Mahat, buddhi can manifest, it is easier, because Mahat is not unconscious in the Veda. In the Sankhya, Mahat is unconscious, but not in the Veda. So that from the higher consciousness of Mahat, in the process of involution, buddhi can arise, can be understood by lower, by going down, devolution. And then there is a further devolution and a further devolution until you come to a point where there is complete darkness. So in the Veda there is a theory of involution. From Mahat all this is coming down. Now if Sankhya theory, the ultimate prakriti, is not unconscious, supposing I regard Sankhya prakriti to be conscious, then I can understand that from Mahat, Ahambhava can arise. From large, small, by devolution can arise. But merely Jada, sometimes Buddhi arises, then Ahambhava arises, and then Tanmatras, and then physical gross realities arise. It looks very, very irrational. So Sankhya account, which is respected by all the Indian traditional thought, can be regarded as almost something uncritically accepted by all systems of philosophy. To the extent to which my researches have gone, I really find that it is a reflection of the Vedic idea of involution. But Sankhya is a kind of a portion taken out of the Veda. It is not purely Vedic. It does not fully reflect the Vedic idea. The very fact that Sankhya regards dualism, whereas Veda is not dualism. Veda and Upanishad is not dualistic. There is a tremendously monotheistic. Veda is at least monotheistic, if not monistic. But it is also monistic. Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Vadanti is a pure monism, not only monotheistic, is pure monism. So that which is pure monism, giving rise to Sankhya, which is dualistic and pluralistic, not only dualistic but also pluralistic, how that theory can be called Vedic is itself a question mark. Simply because the Sankhya thinkers pay a tribute to the Veda. They say we are derived from the Veda, and Veda is unquestionable, Shruti is accepted, therefore we call it Vedic. But not...
But dear sir.
Yes.
Perhaps Sankhya is not so much faithful to the Ved in its own confession, in the sense that it says that all Vedic rituals, since they involve violence, therefore they are not sinless. That is what the Sankhya itself confesses.
So I am just corroborating what you say.
Yes.
Leaving aside your judgment. Even the Sankhya confession is there. If Vedic rituals are not sinless, that is what they say themselves. They are only partly following the Ved and not fully.
Not fully.
If you fully follow it, you cannot say that they are not sinless.
Yes, quite right.
They are prescribed in the Ved and you say they are not sinless. What does it mean? That the Vedas are prescribing sinful things. That comes to that.
Yes.
Therefore, I agree with it that it is not a fully Vedic system. But in the Vedanta also, sir, my understanding was that it is from the subtle that the gross comes, in the sense that this world has come out of Brahman. The world is gross, Brahman is subtle. So my understanding of Vedanta is also this, that it is a devaluation when there is any process, in the sense that we start from pure consciousness and end with this dead matter.
Supraphysical is the basis. What you say, subtle or the supraphysical?
Yes. So, if in the process it is a process of growth from the subtle, how come this, that from matter will come life and from life mind and from mind supermind? This is a reverse order from the order that we understand of creation. In creation, the order is from subtle to gross. And now Sri Aurobindo says us to believe that it will be from grosser to the subtle.
No, but Sri Aurobindo speaks of involution first. In the involution, it is from subtle to gross. And that is also the Vedic view. The Vedic view is that from the Mahat, there has been a gradual devolution into Tamas.
Sir, if it is that,
yes,
it is understandable for human beings to attempt from evolution. What brought about that devolution? There cannot be any effort on any intelligent being to devaluate him.
Now that is the question where I would go back to the Agamashra Mantra, where it says very clearly, in the beginning was only the truth and the right. Then came out Ratri, and then Samudra Arnavaha, a great darkness. After that, you take up the Nasadiya Sukta. We say that out of the complete darkness, there arose the breath. And Kamha Asit Agre. Then came life. And life is the seed of mind. Manasaha Retas. So life itself is described as the retas of mind. So Nasadya Sukta describes that from complete darkness came out a breath, kama, life force, and from life force came the mind. And after the mind has come out, somewhere, the truth of Purusha Sukta is to be fitted. As I said once, that the different suktas of the Veda are to be read in a certain order. Purusha Sukta describes that stage where whatever happened in the history of the world, at a given time, Purusha was sacrificed. And as a result, all the manifestation has taken place. So at what stage and why Purusha was sacrificed, this is a mystery which is not sufficiently understood. Now there must have been something, some knowledge, which is still not fully manifest. The mother was explaining the world. She said there is even a pre-Vedic tradition. According to the mother, there is a pre-Vedic tradition. Even the Veda itself speaks of Purvebhi. So that there were ancient, more ancient people is also confirmed. So there is nothing surprising when we say that there was a pre-Vedic tradition. Now mother had made a study of pre-Vedic tradition also. In fact, mother's capacities of consciousness were so great that she even describes that when the very first human being evolved, she was present. And she has said it very clear that even when the first human being was evolved on the earth, she was present. Maybe she herself was one of the first human beings on the earth. So she was able to go to that tradition from which many accounts which require to be fitted into the one complex whole. Now, if that thing is to be explained, mother said, that when the first manifestation took place, four beings were manifested. Now, these four beings were beings of light, delight, life, and truth. Truth, life, light, and delight. Four beings were manifested according to that tradition.
What are those four?
Truth, life and delight. Now in the Aghamashva mantra, something of this is reflected when it says that first was the tapas, tapasodhyajayata, at the very beginning. And first was ritam cha satyam. So ritam cha satyam refers to truth at least. Tapas may be a process of incubation or whatever, the power of light or whatever it is.
It could be light.
Could be light. Now, if that is so, and if ultimate reality is Satchidananda, then truth, light and delight could be quite understandable. And we also know that light has two aspects, chit, shakti, consciousness and force. So light and life is dual, that also can be understood. So if that is true, it can be said that ultimate reality being Satchidananda, it is quite logical that the first manifestation must be of four beings who represent these four aspects. So that fits in with the ultimate idea of the Veda, that ultimate reality is Satchidananda, and the first manifestation naturally would be, there is no deviation from there. Four manifestations are the manifestations of Satchidananda. Now comes the problem. Mother says that these four beings decided to manifest in a particular manner. Namely, to manifest in such a way that they could hide from their consciousness the reality. Now this is the real mystery. They decided, they resolved to manifest further by hiding themselves, that is to say, a process of concealment arose. Now that there is somewhere a movement of concealment is also recognized in the Veda and the Upanishad. There was a time or there was a plane where Satyasya Hiranmayam Patram is Apihitam. That is, both in the Veda and the Upanishad, this description is given. The face of the truth is covered by the truth. And in the Upanishad, this is the Veda. And in the Upanishad, Hiranmayena Patrena, Satyasya Mukham Apihitam. This also is a fact in the Upanishad. So that somewhere at a certain stage, this movement of concealment did arise. Now this movement, you may say, is a mystery. Why should it arise? And this question we can come back to afterwards, why? But as a process, we can see that this happened. And this is what Mother has written in her own handwriting, this story she has written while explaining the first line of Savitri, because Savitri also begins with the book of beginnings. So describes the first condition of beginning, and the very first line is, it was the hour before the gods awake. And Mother has said, it is a description of that stage where gods had not yet come into being. So, and then Sri Aurobindo describes the period, the what description he gives is the Vedic description of the darkness wrapped in darkness. If you read the first few lines of Savitri, you get these lines of complete darkness described. So you might say the beginning as we see, not the absolute beginning, not from the story which I gave just now. But if you see only a first stage, like Nasadhya Sukta, it doesn't say how that darkness came about. Similarly, Sri Aurobindo also begins with like Nasadhya Sukta. But there is an anterior story. And that is why Mother, while commenting the first line, she gives this anterior story, that this line can be understood only if you know the earlier story as to how this came about. And she gives that story, which she says is pre-Vedic story. And this story, she said, even in Chaldean civilization, that story is known. In the ancient Chaldean civilization, this story was known. So, it is that knowledge which is extremely important to answer this question that you are raising. In the Veda, if you read only the Vedic hymns, you won't get an answer to this question, excepting a little sprinkling of some indications, like a Gamatra mantra. It doesn't say how, why should Ritam Cha Satyam should ultimately result in Ratri? Why should it happen? There is no explanation in the Veda. Nor is the description of evolution described in the Veda, except that it begins with the darkness. Nasadhya Sukta only says darkness, life and mind. And then, if you now combine the Purusha Sukta, at a certain time there was a sacrifice of the Purusha, as a result of which this whole world manifested. Now these are all the glimpses given to us, and if you want to fit into one consistent story, then this can be done when, if you understand what Mother has said about the beginnings of the universe. Now, having seen this, when these four beings decided, sometimes you use a very great word like deviation. These four beings deviated from the Supreme. And then Mother says that this deviation turned these four beings into what are known in the world today as Asuras. These four beings were the Supreme manifestations, but by virtue of this deviation, they have become the Asuras. And these four beings plunged further into themselves, as a result of which inconscience came out. This is Mother's explanation of the beginning. Now, this whole process of involution is presupposed, this whole period of involution is presupposed as a precedent of the process of evolution. Now, in the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo says very clearly that evolution cannot be explained except in terms of an earlier involution. Now, he does not describe here in the first chapter from where this involution has come about. Why has it come about? There is no explanation here. But later on, because the first chapter is a kind of a rapid summary, and certain questions are left unanswered, this question as to how this process of involution has taken place begins to be explained from the chapter 16th onwards. If you see the chapter number 16, the triple status of the supermind.
Yes, it is there. 154 in my book.
Yes. So, in the triple status of the supermind, Sri Aurobindo describes the first status, then the second status, and then the third status. Now, having the third status, if you read the third status, Sri Aurobindo says that from the third status, something happened by the intervention of avidya. In fact, Sri Aurobindo introduces the word avidya at that stage. If you, for one line, I will show you here so that in future when you read it, it becomes much easier. Page number 160 here.
It is a different edition.
Second last page.
I don't know. This is what volume, I don't know. Of this chapter, no. It is. That's right.
It is
148. You've got 148, is it?
Yes.
That's right. 148, correct. So, it may be said, read here. The previous paragraph describes the third status of the supermind. And now comes in his description, it may be said
that the first consequence would be a lapse into the ignorance of avidya.
That's right. This is the first time in the Life Divine the word avidya is introduced.
Which takes the many for the real fact of existence and use the one only as a cosmic sum of many.
This is the starting point of avidya, the description of avidya.
But there would not necessarily be any such lapse.
That's right. That is to say, from third status, next one could be ignorance, but it is not a necessary consequence unless there is a will.
For the individual divine would still be conscious of itself as the result of the one and of its power of conscious self-creation. That is to say, of its multiple self-centration. conceived so as to govern and enjoy manifoldly its manifold existence in the extension of time and space. This true spiritual individual would not arrogate to itself an independent or separate existence. It would only affirm the truth of the differentiating movement along with the truth of the stable unity, regarding them as the upper and lower poles of the same truth, the foundation and culmination of the same divine plane. And it would insist on the joy of the differentiation as necessary to the fullness of the joy of the unity.
It's a description of divine rasa, in which multiplicity and unity and all that is in complete harmony. So lapse into ignorance is not inevitable. But if it happened, it is because these four beings who were having this rasa, they decided that is a lapse. That lapse is not inevitable. Ignorance and the evil in the world are not inevitable, according to Sri Aurobindo. They have happened as a result of this lapse, which was optional. Now you may ask the question, why this option, which was available, why this option was exercised? I will not immediately answer that question, but let it be left unanswered. This is a big question. Why this lapse took place? Now, this particular lapse did take place. These four beings did decide to conceal from them the Supreme Light. Ignorance actually means ignoring. Ignorance does not mean destroying. You just ignore. So, these four beings decided to ignore the Supreme. And they began to act as if that Supreme doesn't exist, like our street. You don't see, therefore doesn't exist. And its action is ignorant. But that does not get extinguished. Mahat remains present throughout, whether you notice it or not. But in the active consciousness, which ignores that reality, there is an effective division from that reality. I act now according to my limited field of consciousness. And then I begin to take many as real and one only as sum of many. That oneness, that unity, ekatvam anupashyataha, that realization is lost. There is no oneness anymore. And this is the parent of ignorance. Once you start with this, what is the end? You go into greater and greater and greater ignorance until it falls into the abyss of inconscience. So this is how Mother explains the beginning of inconscience. Now when that inconscience arises, now Mother tells a story. The supreme, supramental Shakti went to the Lord and said, this is what has happened. Mother uses the word, even the word accident, that this accident has occurred. But she put the word accident in order to commas. It's not exactly accident, because in the divine consciousness there is no accident as such. But an accident takes place. So Supreme Lord now at that stage decides how to deal with it. One decision could have been, tathastu, let it remain like this forever and ever. It could have. This ignorant abyss would have remained as it is. But the Supreme Divine said, that now this abyss has to be remedied, redressed. Now, how do you redress it? It would not be possible for the Supreme Lord and the Mother to turn a magic wand because they are omnipotent. And ignorance at this abyss could have been immediately brought back to light. These asuras could have been brought back. That also was one possibility. The Supreme Lord did not decide that way. You may say, why he did not? We can put that question later on. But this is what happened. I'm only telling the story. These four asuras had fallen into complete darkness. The Divine Mother was told that now you have to remedy. For remedying, she said, the Lord said, you now create new beings. You had put forth four beings, now you put forth new beings and give them an order not to behave as the first four ones behaved. The four ones had decided to deviate. Otherwise, the same consequence also might happen with the others also. So Divine Mother was told, now you produce other beings out of your own being and tell them not to have that kind of game with the other ones have played. Tell them now to make this abyss of darkness luminous. A task is given. As a result, the gods came into being. That is why in the Veda also, gods are later creation. Nasadhya Sukta itself says that when the darkness came into darkness, nobody knows the mystery because even gods do not know because even gods were not present at that time. So what Mother says fits in with the story of the Nasadhya Sukta, that the gods were then the second creation. The first creation were the first four beings, Satyam Charitam and Tapas. But now the gods were created and they are all gods because luminous. These gods are described in the Veda. All the gods, the whole pantheon is what they produced. Now, according to the Mother, these gods went to visit the field of darkness. And they came back to the Divine Mother and said, this darkness is so dense, we don't think we shall be able to handle it. This can't be done. So now you kindly do something. But then the God said to the Divine Mother, that we know there is in you a power. That power, if that power comes down here in the darkness, then we promise that power will be held by us all. But it is by that power that this darkness can be turned into light. When this was done, then the Supreme Mother took out that element from her, which was shown by the gods to be lying in the bosom of the Divine Mother. And that was put forth. Now this putting forth is described in Purusha Sutta. The Purusha, the whole sacrifice, as Sri Aurobindo says, the Divine Mother sacrificed herself and came down into this abyss. This Purusha Sutta, Sri Aurobindo says, that sacrifice of Prakriti is actually the sacrifice of Purusha, because in their eternal being, Purusha and Prakriti are not two different powers, they are one and the same. So, the sacrifice of Prakriti was actually sacrifice of Purusha. And it is that Purusha sacrifice which is described in the Purusha Sukta. Now, this Purusha himself came down, along with it, along with the Divine Mother, Divine Lord himself. That element, most essential element of which the gods had seen, also came down. And that is what is designated by the Veda as Agni. Agni is that which the gods had seen in the waters of the divine being. This is what Vishwamitra says in one of his suktas, that Agni was seen in the waters of the divine being, and that Agni was put forth into the abyss. And that is why Agni is the latest one. He is the last god. And he is a very special place, because the gods have promised that if Agni is invoked, we all will come and help. That is why in the Veda, Agni is specially described, Devo Devevhiragamat. He is the one god which if you invoke, all the gods come. So if you want all the gods to help you, you call Agni. And wherever Agni is invoked, all the gods will come. So it's also Vedic knowledge. Now this Agni element is what may be called in the Puranic sense, the first original avatar. This Purusha Sukta is the first avatar, the Supreme Lord and Supreme Divine Mother came down on the, in the inconscient. And if evolution has taken place, it is thereafter evolution has taken place. And that is why the Veda describes that the first movement of Agni. Agni is the, as you rightly said, the Veda says, Agni is the Lord of matter. And that is quite true. That it is out of, because of Agni presence, matter has come out. Out of that, Aushadhis have come out. Out of the Aushadhis, all these creatures have come out. Out of the creatures, man has come out. So the whole movement of evolution is an evolution because of the presence of Agni. So Mother has given this story that this is the real story of involution and evolution. Now this story, Sri Aurobindo does not describe in the Life Divine. Because Life Divine is a philosophical work. In a philosophy, you cannot have a place where philosophically you cannot demonstrate. In a Puranic story, you can write the story, but the style, the system, Sri Aurobindo is very particular that if it's a book of philosophy, it should be philosophically stated. And this story, Mother also herself said that I am telling a story as a story to be told to small children, because it's such a profound story that if you really want to tell the story exactly as it happened, you have to bring all the glory of the Supreme and the great freedom that is available to the Supreme, and who can allow even the gods to deviate from himself. What a majesty it is. His freedom is so great that he is not at all thwarted by the deviation of these small little beings there. His majesty remains the same, and he can play with them as he likes. He's a majestic, omnipotent Lord. So if you want to describe it exactly as it happened, a great poet has to write it somewhere, the whole story. In any case, unless this story is explained, this mystery of which you are speaking remains a mystery. But you might say that this book is complete because Sri Aurobindo does admit a process of involution. Why involution should take place? Why should it happen? Now, if I reflect philosophically, I would venture to answer that question. Why? We speak of the divine consciousness as omnipotent consciousness, as a consciousness of delights, and as a consciousness which is utterly free. These three statements are to be, first of all, the starting point of our argument. You might say that in the context of all that is said, these three statements are automatic. If divine is the only being existing, ekam sat only, then there is nothing which can limit it. Therefore, it is free. My freedom can be abridged only if somebody else comes and abridges me. Therefore, that being only one and no other, ekam eva advityam, then it must be a free being. It must be omnipotent because that free being is capable of any method of manifestation. It is not limited to one method of manifestation or the other. This being contains all possibilities. The only thing it does not contain is the impossibility. But otherwise, it contains all the possibilities. Whatever is possible is contained in it. Now, if the reality contains all possibilities, all methods of manifestation, it is even free not to manifest at all also. There is no compulsion. It is free. If he had to remain alone, there is no question that he was bored by being alone, not at all. It's a wrong statement when you said divine was alone and he was bored, so he created the world. He does not need to be to be delighted by having company unnecessarily. So, that is a very banal way of saying it is not true. But it is true that Bahusyam Bahusyam was a decision taken by him. Why? Because it was possible for him. To be many was a possibility and he decided freely. His delight was not to manifest, that also was a delight. To manifest was also delight. Purnam adaha purnam idam. So there is no question of his not being perfect in any state. So let us say he decided to manifest. Now when he manifests, what does he manifest? He manifests himself. There is nothing else than manifesting. Now, this manifesting himself is the mystery and the wonder of it. What do you mean by manifesting? There must be a distinction between unmanifest and the manifest. This manifestation gives rise to the concept of the other. This is the important point. That the moment there is a manifestation, he decides to become other than himself, without ceasing to be himself. He is omnipotent. Even though he becomes other than himself, he remains himself. This is what is called the process of objectivization. He is able to mirror himself, see himself, but this mirroring himself is other. That is why the Veda says that that reality is advutam. Kas tad Veda yad adbhutam. It is adbhutam. Why? Because anyasya chittam abhisancharinyam. The moment it manifests, becomes sancharinyam, it becomes other than himself. Anyasya chittam abhisancharinyam. This anya is the most mysterious thing in the whole creation. This capacity of objectivization to become other, in the terms of Bhagavad Purana, Sri Krishna becoming Radha himself, and Radha as Krishna and Krishna as Radha, and yet Radha being different from Sri Krishna, and having a very peculiar relationship between Radha and Krishna, so that Krishna is a servant of Radha, and Radha is a servant of Krishna. This kind of a special relationship that exists is because it is the same reality. There is no loss of oneself. The other is myself. So, this mystery was known to the Vedic rishis, that manifestation implied this kind of anyasya chittam abhisancharinyam. This is the only thing which is beyond intellect. Uta aditam vinashyati. You cannot understand it. If there is anything that is ununderstandable basically, is this power. It's a peculiar power. And it is, you can only say it is that power. Such is the reality, having a mysterious power of becoming himself, remaining himself and yet becoming other than himself. Once you start with this, his freedom must also be present in the other one. If he is free, then that freedom also must be present there. Now, what is the meaning of freedom here and freedom there? This is a matter of a great reflection and contemplation. If I put myself a figure of my being, I am free to do so, and I am there now, there also I don't cease to be free. So even Radha is also free. Sri Krishna is free, Radha is also free. Now this freedom implies that Radha freely offers herself to Sri Krishna. Freely. There is no compulsion on Radha. Out of freedom. But in the relationship, Radha also can say, I won't look at you. It's also freedom. And that's why we have lot of quarrel between Sri Krishna and Radha. That is also possible. Because of this freedom. It's only a play, but that play is a play of freedom. And that is what makes a play so joyful. There is no compulsion. If you like to be with Sri Krishna, you can be. If you want to go away from Sri Krishna, also you are free. But going away from him is actually impossible, except in a certain degree, because reality is only one. From where can you go away? Now, that mystery is repeated when she manifested four beings. These four beings also are nothing but the Supreme. Because Radha is also Supreme, and the four beings also are himself, because there is nobody else than himself. Therefore, this freedom should be present also in these four beings. Therefore, these four beings are free, as much as the Supreme Lord. Now, because of this reason, there is a play of freedom. Supreme Lord may will one thing, these four beings may will something else. They are free. Therefore, the Supreme Being over here may will something that he does not will here. Here he does not will that they should deviate from himself. But here he wills that now there are many possibilities. deviating and manifesting from the Supreme is one of the possibilities. Therefore, they deviated. So if you ask the question, why they deviated? That was one of the possibilities of the play. And allow, they played, then now the Supreme Lord says, alright, let them play. I shall also play another game now with them. He says to the Supreme Mother now, you create other beings, but tell them that freedom which was given to them, I won't give to them. That is also play. It's a freedom. So you might say, if anybody asks a question, why they deviated, the answer is that they deviated because that was one of the possibilities. And they freely chose that possibility. That is the only answer. Now, the only question that could be raised is that if deviation meant choosing a lesser good against a greater good, then there will be a problem. But the possibilities of the divine are all equally good. All the God being good himself, every part of his being is good, every possibility of his is good. Therefore, even the decision to deviate is also as good as the other one. Who says that deviation by hiding himself from the divine, the game will not be so nice? Of course, other game could have been, but this also is a good game. As good as the other one. You may of course cry that because of this, so much of pain and suffering. And therefore it is worse. According to some stories, this whole thing, this damn evil thing that has happened, how can you say it is as good as the other one? But ask anybody who has written to God, it was a good game. Those who return to God, they don't complain. They say we had a very good game, very intense game. So how can you say it was a bad game or a lesser game? It was one good game, like many other games. Either you play with playing cards or play cricket. All are equally good games. Therefore, this is one important consequence which has happened. Now, in this movement, the gods, now the story continues. Now there are how many players? There is God, there is the Supreme Mother, there are four beings who have become asuras, their darkness has come about, then the gods have come, then the Supreme Lord and Supreme Mother and the Agni have come down. And now Agni is a real tiller. The whole burden is actually given to Agni. That's why Agni complains in the Veda at one time. Oh yes, there is a verse I will show you sometime where Agni says that gods deceived me. They told me into darkness and they did not tell me how difficult was the task. There is a sukta in the Veda where Agni says, because afterwards gods went to him to do another task. He said, this is all I agreed to do it.
So then the players that you have described, we come to Durga Saptashati perhaps for this.
It is true, it's a fact. All this now falls in place. All Puranas, everything falls in place with this story told. everything becomes so consistent and intelligible that this is the real drama which is going on. There is a Supreme Mother, the Supreme Lord, Agni, and we all are plunged into it. This is also our story. That is to say, we being the children of the Mother, we are individuals, jivatmans. We also, when our mother goes down, we said, we also will go down. There's a very interesting letter of Sri Aurobindo called The Riddle of This World. When you find time, you read this particular letter, where he has explained this. And maybe that we read it here, so that the story becomes complete. Can you bring that letter? It is, I think, in the first volume, as a third volume, The Riddle of This World. Because this is a riddle. The whole world as it is a riddle.
Sir, is it true that this riddle will remain riddle as long as we think on mental level? Because on mental level, we cannot understand how the option that was chosen by them is as good as any other option. At the mental level, it is not understandable. It can be when we supersede the mind.
No, even at the mental level, it is possible. Provided we understand the nature of suffering, nature of pain, nature of evil. If you understand it properly, even at the mental level, and that is what requires a real metaphysical acumen, to really impartially understand what exactly is error. Because basically, pain, suffering and evil, all this is translatable ultimately into the problem of error. Already 8:15 now. I don't know how much time you have, because it will take at least half an hour to read this particular passage.
Sir, I am told today by your disciples.
No, I have no disciples at all.
I have, sir.
Oh, no.
And I was told that perhaps it is too much for us to trouble you that much. Therefore, I request that we stop this thing here.
All right. You read it when you find time.
I shall be doing it.
Or if I give you the page number, you read.
You note down the volume number. Volume ka number note kar le. Aapne paas to pura complete set hai. Volume ka number note kar le. I shall read it. In the meantime, I shall take 5-4 minutes more.
Yes, certainly.
Rather than that half an hour.
This is volume 22. And page is 24.
I see.
That long letter it is.
Small booklet separately published.
Riddle of the World.
Yes, sir.
All right. Good. The same thing is given. Good. You give me also one copy. I don't have it with me. Make a photocopy of it.
Sir, one thing. I have been to Motilal Banarsidas.
Yes.
And he agreed that in this series, a volume on modern philosophers should also be included. But NPJ. But he said that it is not within his power to do anything. It is Karl H. Potter who is organizing the whole thing. He is only a publisher. Therefore, he gave me his address and email address also, that better if we contact him on this. Give a copy of it to Motilal. He would support our proposal. That's what he can do at the most. He can't take any decision on his own. So, as Potter's address is there, and then the man who is supporting this financially is Rajiv Malhotra, who is known to you. His address he has also given to me, Motilal Banarsidas, that to write to both of them the whole proposition, a copy to Motilal, he will also support it. So I am leaving these two addresses.
No, but my request to you is that you write.
Sir, but the letter has to be drafted by you. I can't draft a letter of that eminence, which appeals to a man like Karl H. Potter. I shall sign it if you like.
Yes.
But it has to be draft from you because...
Your standing in the philosophical and Sanskrit world is so great that it will carry its own weight.
Sir, I propose that both of us sign it jointly in the sense that I being known as a Sanskritist and you being known as a philosopher, it is a combined thing. It is philosophy as well as Sanskrit. Therefore, a letter has to be drafted by you. I'm sorry to tell you this. I should have done it, but I know I can't do it. Therefore, I'm asking for your help. And then, also this Rajiv, what Motilal Banarsidas told me was this, that if Rajiv Malhotra agrees to it, he will persuade Carl H. Potter, because he is holding the finance for this project. He is the financier.
I see.
So we write to both of them, if you like my name to be included, I have no objection. But why do we propose all this? The reasons for that have to be told by... This is the scheme, sir. The whole scheme. I have got a copy of it. The published and the unpublished. So this is the basis on the basis of which we can draft the letter. And I use the word disciple to which you didn't agree.
Yes.
But I find that there are many committed scholars here. If this thing is accepted by them, all of them can contribute to it successfully. So this is a practicable suggestion, not impracticable. For example, if I suggest on Madhusudan Ojha, I don't have such a team with me, and I will be too much burdened myself on that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a team, including Akhilesh himself. I want to get him into the business somewhere. He's flying away everywhere. So, sir, I have got four volumes of this.
Already.
Tomorrow I shall be bringing them. So that we know what is the scheme. The scheme is like this, in short. That first of all, the editor, general editor will be Carl H. Potter. For Aurobindo, you shall be the editor. Now, editor writes a comprehensive introduction of 100-150 pages. And then, summary, para-wise, of all works of the man with whom we are dealing. In this case, Sri Aurobindo and Magar. And if any other person, should. So that is the scheme of that. And it is a useful scheme in the sense that one who doesn't have all the works of Sri Aurobindo with him, with that alone, he can refer to something because we give page number and para also there. That is what he has done in other volumes. So he need not go necessarily to the original volume. With this volume alone, he can refer to Sri Aurobindo's opinion and quote it like that. That is his scheme. Therefore, it is a useful thing. I shall be bringing 5 volumes which are with me. Tomorrow, you can have them. This is one proposition, sir. These 2 addresses, and address of Motilal Banarsidas and his phone number, and then whom I contacted personally, and he suggested all this. He agreed. This is one proposition, so that if something of this type is included in that series, it will be something useful for all those who read Indian philosophy through that series. And it is a very good series. Very good series.
It's very important.
Very important. Sir, I have a book with me on Shiksha Darshan. It is in Hindi, of course. But this, we were talking yesterday about philosophy of education.
Yes.
And there are 3 authors to it. One of them is professor, another is ex-professor, and third one is reader. And all of them have written on the philosophy of education, including Sri Aurobindo, about 13 pages on Sri Aurobindo's philosophy of education, and others, Bodh, Jain, Zakir Hussain, Gandhi, Tagore, Vivekananda, Herbert Spencer, Rousseau, and all that. So I'm leaving this book to you because you are working on education. This is more useful for
good,
you.
Good.
And though it is in Hindi, but
this is all right.
Again, your disciples can help you. Yes. I thought that this is a good book for that purpose. Perhaps, are you aware, sir, of any other book on philosophy of education, there must be other books also, isn't it?
Or is there is one produced by Lal Bahadur Shastri Vidyapeeth.
I see. Yeah.
Bhaskar Mishra has written a book.
Oh.
But what I am looking for is not available.
Could be that this helps you in a way.
Maybe. I will see. Yes. But what I am looking for is not here. Any of the books that I have read, giving an account. You know, Shiksha is one of the Vedangas. Among the eight Vedangas,
yes, yes.
Shiksha is a Vedanga. I have asked many people, can you give me that Vedanga called Shiksha? Everybody says, yes, we shall give you, but nobody has been able to give you. Mm-hmm. I request you also, if you can find out the text of Vedanga called Shiksha.
That perhaps I have got with me.
I would like to see, yes.
One of my colleagues had edited that, because in this University Grant Commission net test, Vedanga Shiksha is prescribed for those candidates who appear for that test. And therefore, one of my colleagues brought out an edition of
it. I would like to see it.
And Satyaprakash Dubey has done it. And I shall be procuring a copy for it, for you. He has commented upon it, that also. That can be done. Sir, has this book of yours translated into Hindi? No?
Yes, yes.
It has been translated.
We have the other two translations. It's already done.
Oh, this one is not.
It's not, no? Because
sir, my point was this, that Rajasthan Patrika was publishing my articles on Ved, Vijnan, Yoga Sutra, Bhagavat, etc. They have stopped at the moment. I thought that since the title of the book is very attractive in the sense that one of our political parties, Bhajapa, is always speaking of Hindutva. And here is a book, Landmarks of Hinduism. Elections are very near. I would consult the editor of Rajasthan Patrika that here is a book on Hinduism. And if he wants to serialize it in his newspapers, then his its Hindi version I can give to him.
Oh, that would be very nice.
On in forms of article. And if he realizes it, if Gulab Kothari agrees to it, I do not know. So I am taking this book. If it has not been translated into Hindi, is there,
perfectly
I shall be doing it.
Perfectly all right.
Time to time. And give him about 30 articles on Hinduism.
Mm, good.
So that people know what Hinduism means. They are always talking of Hinduism. In the newspaper, there is no day where Hindutva is not referred to by somebody or other. Which Hindu Parishad or RSS or Bhajapa, everybody. Previously, even Congress people were referring to it. Now they are afraid of referring to it. They think that Hinduism is something which goes against secularism. Otherwise, Purushottam Das Tandon or Radha Krishnan or Rajendra Prasad, all they were referring to Hinduism all the time. So this is another proposition, sir. And this is for giving you some happiness that perhaps you know. Here is a book on Adhunik Shiksha Manovigyan, written by one of my students.
Oh, I see. Oh.
In Sanskrit.
Oh, really?
Yes,
oh,
so that you will be happy that Sanskrit is still being used.
Oh, good.
As a vehicle for modern thoughts, because Shiksha Manovigyan is a modern subject. But on that also, some of them are writing in Sanskrit also. Perhaps you are aware of this fact.
No, I don't.
But this is Adhikam Shiksha Manovigyanam in Sanskrit. Purely in Sanskrit. Sanskrit is not a dead language. It is still being used for practical purpose.
Mm,
he was my student in B.A. and M.A. Then he did Shiksha Shastri.
Okay.
And now he's a reader in Shiksha Shastri.
Right. Okay.
Somewhere in Bombay.
Yes.
Lokman.
Lokman.
Now he's Bombay. Chala gaya.
Sir,
many people are writing in Sanskrit on most modern subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And though I'm not very efficient in writing Sanskrit, but I propose to write something on Sri Aurobindo.
In Sanskrit. Oh, great.
But before that, I have to understand him fully. Because Sanskrit is a language in which incomplete things are not written.
There is one little book written by Jagannath Mishra.
Jagannath. Arvinda Darshanam, I suppose. Yes.
One Upanishad also is.
Yes. I shall get that. I shall get that. But I want to write in Sutta and Bhashya form, so that it becomes a classical text. On Satprem's work, I have written in Sanskrit. I gave a copy to you also, with English translation. Sir, last but not the least is a question from my wife. Yes, please. It is an important question, sir, because it is not a personal question. It is a question which pertains to all of us. She says that she feels that in this life, she doesn't have the feeling of fulfillment, which every one of us, most of us don't have, that we have a sense of fulfillment. And she is worried about her life hereafter, being an old lady at the age of 60. Rather old person, not lady. At the age of 70, every one of us after this age starts worrying about life hereafter. So, what is her future? That is her question. Now kindly listen to her. Yes. That is an important question. She wants me to put this question to you. And it was my wife's duty to put this. That one who has not a sense of fulfillment and is at the end of his life or her life, what will happen to him or her in life hereafter? And what can he or she do with the remaining of life, which may be very short?
First of all, there can be fulfillment even in this life, even though one may not have it already. One need not think that one is going to pass away. You can think 25 years more are ahead of you. So one need not be in that way in a state of anxiety about it. Secondly, that even one day more may not be available. It also is possible for all of us, any one of us, whether young, old, or it is possible to any one of us. Even then, one can, if one has done his or her best, even though that best may remain incomplete, there is a sense of fulfillment. If one knows that one has done one's best, whatever I could, whatever I should have, as long as one has done that much, even that could be a fulfillment. The sense of unfulfilled condition arises when I have not inquired what I ought to be doing and I have not yet got the answer for it. I am still looking for the answer. I have still not got the answer in spite of my effort. Then one certainly feels all the time unfulfilled. Now the answers can be of three kinds. One is like answer demanded by Arjuna to Sri Krishna, who tells Sri Krishna, do not bewilder my mind. Then Sankhya is also a part. Yoga is also a part.
Bhakti is another part.
Bhakti is also another part. And you must act. And then next time I say, buddhi is even higher than the karma. So one can tell Sri Krishna, as Arjuna did, do not bewilder my mind. You just tell me what I should do, and that's the end of the matter. I will do it. So this is one demand one can make. to Sri Krishna, because he can give that answer also. Trust that if you ask this question, Sri Krishna will tell you. So that is the one question of trust. Even overnight you will get the answer. If you really say, I really want to know what I ought to be doing. And if he takes more time to answer, you think that he wants you to have more time. That tomorrow is not the end. We are sure about it. Once you have gone to him and told him these questions, do not bewilder me, but give me the answer, what I should be doing. Then trust, he will give the answer. A better question would be simply, I do not even want to know what I ought to be doing, but see that at the end of my life I feel fulfilled. And trust, this will be done, the first. So either of these two positions you can take, and there should be no need of any sense of unfulfilledness. This is at the level of what can be told at the highest to anybody. At the highest. If one is prepared to listen to the highest wisdom, this is the highest wisdom. That there is the Divine Lord. People may question whether God exists or not, so I'm not saying that you should go into it. Highest wisdom says God exists. If you want to debate, you go to philosophical society and debate it and waste your time over it. But the point is God exists. This is the answer of wisdom, not of philosopher. God exists. Secondly, God knows you better than anybody else, more than you. And he knows the answer to your question. So, you just, tonight itself, you close your door, be alone, and in trust, you just put this little thing, a letter, write, you can write down a short letter. That I know you know me the best. I am feeling unfulfilled. My prayer to you is, please give me a sense of fulfillment. I want to do the best, and be in your hands. At the end of this life cycle also, I want to be in your hands. You know how to take me in your hands. I do not know. From today, all responsibility lies in you. Trust it and sleep away. Finished. Bas, ye hona chahiye. Bas, ye kar do. Even now, it will be over. This is the highest answer one can get. But highest answer is sometimes not practicable. Because everybody, you will do it, I know. But I'm saying that highest answer is not practicable by many people. They don't want the highest answer. They want to linger on. They want to debate. They want to be satisfied. Because they want to be sure that, well, I know, but that is all that we are here. What my problem is that we are all mental beings. So even if you say that believe God exists, then you'll say you are all dogmatic. You are superstitious and you are enlightened, rational human beings full of light. You cannot be dogmatic. You should really know. You must really catch hold of God before your eyes. You must really see Him. Then you can believe Him. That also is the attitude of mind, for example. How many of us have followed this path and wasted so many years? Even Kartikeyan, he went round the whole earth. Ganesha was wise. So, he did the wisest thing in the world. So, we should be like Ganesha. and know that God is here only. Even if you don't see, He sees you. You may not see Him, so what? He sees you. So I would simply say that you just do this little exercise, finished. And don't worry, He will show you what is to be done. Once you have told Him, this conversation must take place. This is the effective method. If we are able to converse with Him in this way, He will do the rest. And then you don't need to worry, because you have done the best. From your side, you have done the best. The best thing is to tell the Lord, go to Him and say, now, I have come to you. It is now your responsibility. If I remain unfulfilled, it is your responsibility, not mine. Because this is the best I can do. I can only come to God, who is all giver, and tell Him, look, I am in your hands. Now do what you like. So this is all my answer to your question.
So I can take this book with me.
Yes, please take it. Oh yes, it's yours. Any book here is yours, actually.